8:15, having arrived, I'll call the Education Finance Committee to order and welcome members. Everyone survived the cold driver walk to the Capitol today. Very good. We do have a quorum, so we have some minutes from January 17th. I would entertain a motion to approve.
So moved.
Representative Wills moves to approve the January 17th, 2013 minutes of the Education Finance Committee. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The minutes are approved. Today I'm excited about what we have in store. Last week we talked about goals, and one of the goals we have is to close the achievement gap and increase student performance. And our kind of three areas of presentation today address that goal. We have three groups here today: St. Paul Public Schools, Vinnie Mines, and Jewish Family and Children's Services. And so the way we're going to work today is about 20 minutes for St. Paul Public Schools, about 60 minutes for Vinnie Mines, and 10 minutes on the Jewish Family and Children's Services. And that will include questions. So I'll be kind of keeping a close tabs to make sure that we get through all of these. But, you know, the emphasis is that we've talked a lot about that we, as a committee, I think from the discussion, we see as a priority to look at efforts and strategies that are data-driven, that have a proven track record of increasing student performance and closing the achievement gap. And so that's what we're looking forward to today. And with that, we have a few testifiers here. If you would introduce yourselves, and please begin, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm thrilled to be here today to talk with you about early learning in St. Paul Public Schools. I'm Lisa Grunewald, the supervisor of the Office of Early Learning in the district, and I'm going to be sharing information about our pre-kindergarten and kindergarten programs. And also, I'm happy to bring Rita Carson, who is a kindergarten teacher at Obama Service Learning Elementary and a semifinalist for Education Minnesota's Teacher of the Year last year. She's going to be sharing authentic classroom implications with you later. I understand we only have 20 minutes, and I could probably talk to you about this for an entire day. It's something I love and am very passionate about. But what I'm going to do is just start with a broad overview of our district, and just to give you some demographics and set the context. Then I'll highlight our early learning efforts, including one of the longest operating, proven successful, and largest pre-kindergarten programs in the state, as well as our all-day kindergarten program. In St. Paul, we are truly blessed with an amazing, diverse population. As you can see, we have a healthy balance of ethnic groups in our district, and this really provides a rich cultural background and an environment for us to have opportunities to explore multiple perspectives. When examining our early learning demographics, you will notice that they are similar to the district. However, we do serve a higher population of English language learners and students who qualify for free and reduced lunch. Our program is really focused on the students who are most risk for later school success. So we have enrollment priorities for our students. Students who qualify for free and reduced lunch, whose home language is something other than English, or qualify for special education, are given priority for our program. 85% of the children we serve qualify for one or more priority. Our program is in extremely high demand, and it's the preferred pre-kindergarten program for many families. It's evidenced by our enrollment data. You can see we serve 1,100 students this year, and we could easily double that with our demand because we have 747 students on our wait list today, and they will not be served this year in our program. As I mentioned, St. Paul Public Schools has been in the business of providing high-quality pre-K for many years, decades really, and we continually work to evaluate what we do, increase our rigor. And our main priority is really to increase access to students most at risk, as I mentioned earlier. In 2004, we started a partnership with the Loka McKnight Foundation and Nancy Latimer at the time, who was then the program director. Through the work with Project Early Kindergarten, we really had two goals. One was to close the achievement gap, and the other was to align with the K-6 elementary education and really focus on giving those students who are most at risk the same level playing field when they got to kindergarten. So we really looked at what was in place and what we had to do to make sure that this program was accessible to those students. So we looked at an easy application process. We knew that income, the income could not be a barrier, so the program was free. Families needed a way to get there, so obviously we provided transportation. But most importantly, we knew we had to meet the families where they're at and provide them services that they could assess. So we have bilingual and bicultural staff in place who spoke the language of the family and understood the family background, so families could be more informed and actually be partners with us in education. PEK was first implemented in 2005 in just 10 schools, and it's currently our district-wide model, serving 1,200 students a year. In addition, back then in 2006, through a partnership with then Resources for Child Caring, which is now Think Small, Leaders in Early Learning, the same instructional model that we had in the schools was also implemented in family homes and child care centers as well. In order to provide a high-quality program, we know we have to hire highly qualified staff to work in our families, to work with our families and in our classrooms. We hold our teachers to very high standards. We also have clear expectations as well as high levels of support. We have very little turnover in our program, and this could probably be attributed to the levels of support. Today is actually one of our professional development days, and so after this, we're going to be scurrying out because we have to go and provide some professional development for staff. We're having a joint training with Head Start, Early Childhood Special Ed, and Pre-K today. In our efforts to align K-6 instructional model, we have a standards-based curriculum that we actually created in the district called Discovering Our World, and it aligns to the Common Core English Language Arts Standards K-12. We also created an instructional model called Early Childhood Workshop, which is something that the children experience in all of our pre-kindergarten classrooms across the district. It's an integrated model of readers and writers workshop that children experience K-5. I think it's important to note that we've trained a lot of educators on using this model throughout the state. We've trained at actually the International Reading Association. That was actually a nationwide training. We trained at MESPA and at the Minnesota Association for Family and Early Education, MNAPI. In fact, there are several districts around the region using our instructional model, including Minneapolis, South Washington County, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, Roseville, Osseo, and even Eau Claire, Wisconsin. We had some folks come from there. In our program, we're extremely focused on data. We look at student outcomes as well as the classroom environment and teacher and student-to-student interactions. Data-driven decision-making is really what we do. We try to focus on the types of instruction that we're offering and make sure that we're differentiating to meet the needs of all of our students based on their academic needs and their social needs as well. In addition to differentiating support for children in the classroom, we have comprehensive differentiated support for families as well. Last year, we served 980 of our 1,100 families in at least one event, and two-thirds of those events had a bicultural and bilingual parent educator serving those families. So the events could include anything from math or literacy events, really anything that the families need or needs that we notice at the school. We also offer a six-week intensive positive behavior and instructional support class for families. Either the families self-select or teachers may refer us to families, and then we recruit them for the program. We just finished a course. We offered it in both English and Spanish, and it is a very powerful course for families to come in and really learn how to problem solve with their children and learn the same techniques and things that we're doing in the classroom so that those practices are connected for the students and for the families as well. Principals, as the instructional leader, welcome families and children into their schools as four-year-olds. So basically, pre-kindergarten is treated as another grade. It's the first grade level that children experience in school. And of course, our office, the Office of Early Learning, as experts in how young children learn, really partner closely with the principals. Clearly, we couldn't do any of what we do without funding. And so it's important to note that our program is funded in large part by a local referendum. We were lucky enough to have voters renew that just this year. We have some schools, school readiness state aid, and right now we're fortunate to be part of two pre-K to third grade grants. One is funded by a local McKnight Foundation, and another federal grant, one of the I-3 grants in partnership with the University of Minnesota. I've mentioned a couple of our partners already, the McKnight Foundation and Think Small, through our Project Early Kindergarten program. It's important to note that, of course, we couldn't do any of the work that we do without our partners in the community. Right now, what we've listed up here are some of our major partners. There are going to be some that aren't listed, but I think it's important that you see that we know that we are not doing this alone. We were a pilot site for Parent Aware and part of the evaluation. All of our programs in St. Paul Public Schools are 4-star rated. Last Up to Kindergarten is a resource for our families, and we partner with the public libraries and the Minnesota Children's Museum for that. United Way of Twin Cities provides a lot of funding, especially for the Minnesota Reading Corps that we have in the district. K-3 and Target as well provides funding. In our district, we have 23 Minnesota Reading Corps members in our pre-kindergarten programs and over 100 tutors combined for reading and math K-3. The work with partners, coupled with everything else I've mentioned, has led to successful outcomes for students. When looking at this slide, this is a graphic from our Wilder research. It was a 7-year longitudinal study of our Project Early Kindergarten, the first 10 schools that we began in. If you look at the blue bar, it indicates the outcomes of children at kindergarten entry after 1 year of participation in the original PEK program. The green bar shows the outcomes of children who did not participate in PEK, but may have been in childcare or another early learning program. You can see the students in PEK outperform their peers in all levels assessed. Specifically looking at vocabulary, the PEK students scored 9 months ahead of their peers on average at kindergarten entry, which is really an entire year's growth. The bottom line shows that PEK secured significant gains in student achievement. All three cohorts of students who participated in this study showed significant academic and social gains over their peers at kindergarten entry. The gains for these students sustained. The evaluation was, as I mentioned, a 7-year longitudinal study, and in looking at the third cohort last year reached third grade, and their MCA scores were above their peers in third grade as well. So district-wide, we've been able to see these gains sustain. Third grade reading proficiency was up 5% from 2006 to 2012. When you look at how I mentioned PEK started in 10 schools and is now our district-wide model, looking at our students across the board, across the whole district in our pre-kindergarten, 87% of them were on target for reading last year when only 30% came in ready. So we had a 57% gain, which in 1 year's time for pre-kindergarten, with 50% of them being English language learners, is pretty amazing. One of the things that sometimes is overlooked but is really an important thing to note is that families and children both have a smooth transition to kindergarten by starting in a school-based program. So children come into the school, they understand how to do the rituals and routines of the school, basically how to do the lunchroom, how to do walking in the halls, all those kind of things which seem maybe insignificant, but it sets the students ready for the academic and social skills that they're going to be learning. If they don't know how to do any of those things, then you spend a great deal of time focusing on that. When the kids come in to kindergarten ready to go, and Rita can talk more about that, their gains will just go further and further. Parents also have an understanding of the school system. When they come in at pre-K, we have that strong parent support that I talked about. It really helps the parents to come in and understand how to negotiate a school system, which I'm sure you all know can be quite cumbersome at times. So I also want to mention that every year when our pre-kindergarten students get to kindergarten, I'll hear one of them say, or I'll hear a teacher remark that the kids say, "This is just like my old school," when in fact it is their old school because their classroom was just down the hall last year. I won't take time to read these to you, but I just want you to know that our parents are thrilled with the program, and many of them take the time actually to send us notes and to talk to us about what they see that their students are gaining. They know that they're getting the necessary academic skills and social skills to interact with others, and that makes parents feel good about the program. We also have some information from what teachers say. Teachers in both the school system and, as I mentioned, in the child care centers and family child care providers that we've worked with have recognized the level of support and become more efficacious in their work. So I've talked a lot about the strong pre-K program, and again, I could go on and on, but I won't. In our efforts in early learning in St. Paul, obviously we go beyond pre-K. So I'd like to talk a little bit about our all-day kindergarten program. All-day kindergarten is available in every school in St. Paul, which is very important. As I mentioned, again, many of the kids who want to get in our pre-K program can't get in, and so we also have children who have never been in any kind of formal setting coming to kindergarten, so that all-day kindergarten gives them an extra boost. That funding is by compensatory integration, Title I, and referendum dollars. According to researchers in the 1990s, the majority of children, over 90%, who entered kindergarten with the skills that they needed to reach the basic literacy skills were ready to learn, should be reading at grade 3. That's the benchmark. All students should be reading by grade 3. We know every year of high-quality education and effective teachers counts. So these following statistics just show some positive outcomes, really kind of return on your investment, if you will, when a district such as St. Paul is committed to providing comprehensive supports for early learning. There's significant growth in MCA proficiency between 2006 and 2012. For two consecutive years, MCA reading proficiency percentages have increased in all subgroups in St. Paul. And St. Paul Public Schools English language learners consistently outperform their peers statewide in reading MCAs. Those are some pretty pretty great data statistics, and something that I think is very important to know, that when you put your time and your money into early learning, you're going to get the gains. Today, so I've told you briefly a little bit about the data and given you numbers for early learning in St. Paul. What I'd like to do is invite Rita to actually tell you what actually happens in the classroom, to really share what it really means for kids.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Rita Karsten. As Lisa mentioned, I'm a teacher at Barack and Michelle Obama Elementary School, which is located just 2 miles from here. Our school consists of 599 students, of which 94% are free and reduced lunch. You've heard Lisa mention the facts and figures for our youngest learners. I'm here to bring these figures to life for you. And I hope, forgive me for reading this, I'm very comfortable talking in front of five-year-olds all day long. Not quite so comfortable in this setting. I've been a kindergarten teacher in St. Paul since 1994. In 1994, we had wonderful half-day programs where students learned the letter of the week, how to write their names, and made some really, really cute art projects. Fast forward 19 years, our scholars, yes, we call them scholars at Obama, our scholars are reading level books, analyzing and discussing texts, writing stories with beginning, middle, and ends using phonetic and conventional spelling in complete sentences. And that's just in our literacy block in the mornings. That high-level learning continues across the curriculum all day long, which is, by the way, all aligned with state standards. This dramatic swing in kindergarten methods is an example of what's possible when scholars enter kindergarten on track for grade-level instruction. In the past, many four-year-olds did not have the opportunity to attend an instructional program. Many of the four-year-old programs were and still are more like a half-day structured playgroup. The programs are not aligned with kindergarten curriculum and do not offer a continuum of learning. The comprehensiveness and alignment of St. Paul Public Schools' pre-K program was very evident this fall as my students began. This is the third year that Obama has had pre-K housed in our building, and we have a large percentage of scholars that roll over into our kindergarten classrooms. And each year that percentage increases. This year, 11 of my 24 scholars are graduates of our pre-K program. Of the 11, 10 of those students consistently perform in the proficient rate in our reading and math assessments. Within an all-day kindergarten program, these scholars are able to receive differentiated instruction at their own academic level. In the years prior to pre-K programming, on average, I would have only 1 to 2 students that performed in that level. Our pre-K students enter kindergarten school-ready and open to learning. Their parents have had opportunities to experience school with their child. Our schools were familiar faces. They're very comfortable. We talk to them every morning as they walk down the hall. They know the expectation and routines of the school, and the anxiety level of starting school is greatly reduced for both parents and children. Through in-depth and ongoing assessments combined with the data from pre-K students, strengths and weaknesses are quickly identified, and students are able to receive instruction and services at their level. Oftentimes, students need special education services have been identified and assessed in pre-K, and they begin receiving these services immediately in the fall. Without an online pre-K and kindergarten program, this would not be possible. Dr. Donald Cruz, a prominent educator from California, had the opportunity to speak to us last year. He says educators are in the business of saving lives. I came into teaching as a second career. My first career was doing quality assurance studies at children's hospitals. These studies were done to ensure patients were receiving the best medical care, experienced fewest complications, and having the healthiest outcomes. Teaching is very similar to that. We look at our students, we teach, we assess, We teach again and assess. We provide interventions and teach and reassess. It's an ongoing process through which scholars receive a quality, my principal actually likes to say premier, education. We're saving lives each day by boosting academic achievement. How do we do this? It all begins in an aligned, high-quality pre-K kindergarten program. Do I believe all my students are success stories? Absolutely. I wouldn't be here today if I didn't. However, some have better beginnings written for their stories through our pre-K program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, are there questions for either Ms. Grunewald or Ms. Karsten? Representative Radinovich.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Ms. Grunewald. There was discussion of 1,100 students or 1,200 students being served through the pre-K program and a waiting list of about 740 or something like that. My question is, you had talked a little bit to your selection process, targeting at-risk students, things like that. Could you, do you have a sense of those students who get in, do they come from, or perhaps those students who don't get in, do they come from homes where the parents may not be as able to navigate the system? Is there, I'm kind of asking about access and barriers to access. And then the second question would be that the test scores that we're looking at for kindergarten, do you think at any point those reflect, you know, again, that access issue of who gets in and who doesn't get in?
Well, Ms. Grunewald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Our pre-K, our waiting list of those 747 kids, there are about 540 that have priority points. So we do know that the majority of students have priority points. I mean, we do an amazing job of outreach to families in the community, and we, in past years, have worked with the Department of Human Services to actually get some enrollment applications right out to those folks who have been served through their system throughout the year. So we sent to about 5,000 families, you know, just to make sure that families get information about screening early and things like that. So I think part of the problem is we just don't have enough spaces to house all those children in our we don't have enough funds, actually, because right now in the district there is a turnover of our sixth grades are moving out, so we will have some extra room in our elementaries, but we need more funding in order to be able to serve all the students, because it's clearly a program that parents want to be in the schools, and so they're coming to us, they're asking for it, we just don't have the capacity right now to serve.
Representative Radinovich?
Ms. Grunewald, do you have a sense of, or do you have the number of people who have been, children who are admitted to the program that have priority points assigned to them?
Who are admitted to our program?
Yep.
85% of our
85%,
students.
Okay, I missed that. Thank you, that's my question.
Thank you. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this question I think is for Ms. Grunewald as well. You had mentioned that the St. Paul Public School pre-kindergarten program is a 4-star rating.
Yeah.
What did that rating look like? What did the process that you went through in order to get that rating?
Ms. Grunewald?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the St. Paul School, or the school-based programs in Head Start actually did have an accelerated process to get the 4-star rating. We still had to write about our curriculum. We had to have some we had to write about our curriculum and provide information about our curriculum, our assessment, professional development for all of our teachers, which was no easy feat to go back a couple 5 years for the 30 teachers to make sure that we could document all the professional development they had. But there is an accelerated process for the school-based programs and the Head Start programs this year.
Okay. And then
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a follow-up to that, these 1,100 kids that are in the program, are any of them on the early childhood scholarships that was passed last year
or
2 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, we do not receive any state scholarships this year. The scholarship program has been challenging for us in the school-based system. For many reasons, a part of it is the portability nature of the funds that the scholarships go with the child. You know, we budget a year in advance for our programming, and we have to hire teachers based on our classrooms and the number of children that we serve, and they're on contract, so we don't have the ability to sort of float teachers in and out of the system. Let me explain. So last week, or a couple weeks ago, on January 12th, we had our school fair, and that was the opening of our enrollment for the school-based system. Thousands of parents come to find out about our schools and our programs, and pre-K is one of them. We didn't stop talking the entire day. I mean, parents were there my voice was just raw by the end of the day, which was exciting and fun. But as I mentioned, we will receive about 2,000 applications for our 1,000 spots. And our enrollment for next year will be set in about a month and a half. So in spring, we're set. We hire teachers in spring based on the number of classrooms and their guaranteed positions under the union contract. So then the scholarships came out in November. So our enrollment was already set, and our families were already in place. We did work to get the word out to our families about their scholarships, and all the information was in English, so we had to take some time to translate the materials once they became available. We took the time to translate them. And we don't see our families every day because we do provide transportation, so the information went home in backpacks. So none of our parents were awarded the scholarships. And we're certainly supportive for increasing access for children. However, I think it's important that we find a model that works for school-based programs as well, because it is an option that parents want, as you can see by our enrollment numbers. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Woodard.
Thank you, and I'll just one more question along that same line. I guess I'm a little confused by the portability issue when you've got 700 people on the waiting list, and the ability to manage that doesn't seem like scholarships would cause issues there, because if you're running a great program. I mean, these are very interesting presentation you gave. So I don't understand why the scholarships would be causing a problem from a planning standpoint.
Well, because as I mentioned, the timing of the scholarships is an issue for the schools. Oh. Because, you know, as I said, our enrollment is already set. If parents came in with a scholarship now in March, they wouldn't be using the funds until September. And so we couldn't bank on them coming to our program in September, so we couldn't hold the spot and hold the classroom. Does that make sense? Because we budget a year in advance for our classrooms and our teachers. That part of the issue is the timing.
All right, I'll take one more.
Can I mention one more thing about the scholarship?
Go ahead.
So I have had 10 parents contact me since the scholarships have come out saying, oh, I have a scholarship, I'd love to come to your program. And I have to tell them that we're full and we have a wait list. So they would, if they join the wait list now, they would never get in. I mean, you know, unless you're about in the top, you know, 20, you're probably never going to get in at this point in time. So,
and Ms. Grunewald, you're saying that, if I'm hearing right, two of the main reasons why you have 700 and so many on the waiting list is space needs and funding needs? Okay. Representative Myra?
Mr. Chair, thank you. This question is for Ms. Grunewald. Recently I was reading the 2010 impact study for Head Start. The Head Start program started many, many years ago in 1965 for the purpose of working on the war on poverty, focusing on our children at risk and underprivileged. And that study showed that there were very few gains that were sustained in the later years. And I'm curious, one, about any information you have on how long these gains are being sustained in your program, and what are the differences between what you are doing and the Head Start program, if you could shed any light on that.
Yeah, Ms. Grunewald, you were talking, and I guess what Representative Myra, I think, piggybacking on that, you're talking about the longitudinal studies. How far have they gone? Have they gone to eighth grade, further? How old is the program? Are we seeing gains in the later years?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our longitudinal study, it was a seven-year study, as I mentioned, and it we're just in the seventh year. Last year was the first time our third cohort was in third grade. So we haven't gone beyond that yet because it's just a newer study. Obviously, our study wasn't in place as long as it started. This fade-out effect you're talking about, which is something that we hear a lot about in early childhood, is that we provide comprehensive services for families. In our program, Head Start provides even more comprehensive services for families because they do some medical funding, things like that. So our programs are similar at this point in time with what goes on in the classrooms. I think part of what happens in that fade-out effect is that schools aren't continuing with that comprehensive supports for families and students, and we're really looking at that in St. Paul and having that all-day kindergarten and really working to have more parent and family. Our district is committed to that and has and created an Office of Family Engagement and Community Outreach, and so those kind of comprehensive services for families have dropped off from early childhood programs. I think that is part of what some of that fade-out effect might be. Also, as I mentioned, we haven't studied our students beyond their grade in this formal longitudinal study. So,
and Representative Myra, we do have some Head Start folks coming in on Thursday, so you can also ask that question. Thank you so much. Sounds like a wonderful program that's garnering good results. Thank you very much. Next, if we could have Mr. Forsberg come forward and representing Many Minds. And just looking at the clock, we'll have for this segment about till 9:30. So a total about 45 minutes, a little shorter than originally planned, but want to leave time for questions, and we do have one more group. So last Monday, a big kickoff. Mr. Forsberg, you were there, did a wonderful job, and I think folks got to see a little bit about what this is all about, but please proceed, and welcome to the committee.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. It's great to be here, and as you can see, I'm joined by a number of colleagues, and we actually have a few more who'd like to speak a little bit later. We'll try to keep our remarks brief, and our objective is to provide you with a good introduction to the current research in early childhood education and some of the on-the-ground practice that is going on in our state. So really just a good introduction and overview to some of the key information that you might find helpful and valuable as you begin to debate and discuss these issues. In my day job, I serve at the Greater Twin Cities United Way as a senior vice president there. And as you know, United Way has had a long commitment to early childhood education, and on behalf of United Way and many others, just delighted to be here with you this morning. I'm going to start the introduction of research by having you go to a one-page handout by the Wilder Foundation and Wilder Research. And I know you've got a number of pieces of paper, so I'm hopeful you can find the one-pager by Wilder. And the title of this one is Minnesota's One-Child School Readiness Dividend. And I see the materials are being distributed. And I'll just start with this as a warm-up introduction to why investing in early childhood education matters from a return on investment perspective. Many of you have heard often about Art Rolnick's initial work from the Federal Reserve, in which the public benefits at a 16-to-1 rate of return for every dollar invested in early childhood education. Well, Mr. Rolnick's work was based on national research and data, very broad cut at this. Wilder now has taken local information from the state of Minnesota and begun to build their own point of view or their analysis on what the return is, or savings is in this case. And so in this document, you will see that for every child who enters kindergarten not fully prepared, it will eventually cost the state of Minnesota $56,000 for one child. So if you think of the scale of this issue, where half our children in the state of Minnesota are not fully prepared to start kindergarten, and you take that figure of $56,000 and you multiply it by the number of kids not fully ready, you're going to end up at a number close to $860 million of increased cost or benefits used to the state of Minnesota, as documented in this summary. And so it's a very dramatic cost to our state for us continuing down the road of allowing half our children to not be fully prepared. And so this is the introduction, rate of return in terms of public investment, why we should be thinking about it from a cost perspective. The full report, of course, is available. We've just given you the executive summary so you can see the high points. So we're going to move on, and I'd like to introduce three of my colleagues today who are going to each speak for a couple of minutes on the key research that they themselves work the most on. First, we'll hear from Megan Gunner. Here's Megan, and she's with the University of Minnesota, one of the most recognized leaders in our community on the brain research that has been evolving over the last decade and how much we have learned on brain development. Rob Grunewald from the Federal Reserve is joining us to speak further about return on investment, and Erica Moss is here to give us an update on Parent Aware for School Readiness, the quality rating system that MELF in recent years has built and developed. So let's begin with Megan Gunner.
Thank you.
Ms. Gunner, if you'd please introduce yourself for the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I want to thank you for having me here today to talk to you about the science of early brain development. As Frank said, my name is Megan Gunner, and by way of putting my remarks in context, I want to tell you a little bit about more about who I am and what I do. I am, as he said, a professor of child development, and I'm a director of the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. In my research, I study the effects of early life stress on brain and behavioral development in children. I was a member of the National Institute of Medicine's panel that reviewed the science of early development and produced the report Neurons to Neighborhoods, which some of you might know. Since that report came out, I have served on the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, which is a group of neuroscientists, pediatricians, and developmental psychologists who are partnered with the National Conference of State Legislatures and the National Governance Association's Center for Best Practices to vet the research on early brain development and provide consensus information to legislators like yourselves to help inform your decision making. And it's in that role that I come to you today. The science of early brain development is based on decades of research in neuroscience and child development. The basic concepts I'm going to describe, and which you have in a handout, in an in-brief handout there in your packet, are established science. They form a sound scientific basis for the investments in early childhood. A very quick tour of what we should take you about, you know, a year to learn. First, it takes more than good genes to produce a healthy, well-functioning brain. Generally speaking, genes provide the basic blueprint for the brain, and they orchestrate when different parts of the brain wire up. The brain wires up through waves of activity that begin with brain circuits that process sensory information, sight, sound, smells, touch. That's basically the back part of your brain. They continue to circuits that allow the child to coordinate sensations and form very basic concepts. And we move on to the regions of the brain that are involved in language. And finally, we continue to those regions that are involved in thinking, planning, organizing, and increasingly controlling one's own thinking, emotions, and behavior. This takes a long time. While we're still putting the finishing touches on the architecture of the brain into our mid-20s, after which, yes, it is downhill, the basic architecture and circuitry of the is established in those first few years of life. The circuits and skills we establish during those years then affect the skills and the architecture that comes later. Skills beget skills. Like building a house, we establish the foundation and set out the frame in the early years of life. If that foundation and frame is faulty or weak, it threatens the whole edifice. Problems discovered in the frame later can be remedied, but usually at a much higher cost in time, energy, and dollars. Second, serve and return provides the basic ingredient that goes into building brain architecture. Brain circuits send signals that produce actions. That's the serve. If the action produces a positive effect, that's the return, and the circuit is strengthened. While we can and do provide children with objects like rattles that react to their actions and help establish good brain architecture, the best opportunities exist in interaction with other human beings and with adults, because we can modify our actions to keep the serve and return going. And the more the child and the person know about each other, the better and richer the opportunities for serve and return. The familiar adult learns what the child serves mean and is better able to provide the appropriate return that keeps the action going and brain circuits developing. Stable, supportive, serve and return relationships with responsive adults provide language and concept-rich environments is critical for developing the type of brain architecture that will set the child, and by extension, our society, up for success. Third, toxic stress damages brain architecture. Threats to well-being trigger the production of stress hormones and neurochemicals that are essential to preserving life under harsh conditions. Experienced early in life, frequent productions of these hormones and neurochemicals and frequent activation of fear circuits in the brain shape a brain that tends to act now and think later, and that is exquisitely adapted to detect threat even when it may not be present. If left unchecked, the production of these stress hormones and chemicals can also damage and even kill brain cells. This doesn't mean we need to wrap babies and young children in shrink wrap to prevent all stress and distress. In fact, in the presence of supportive adults with whom the child has a trusting relationship somehow, and we actually still don't understand how this is happening, will block stress even if the child is really upset. And it allows the child to learn to cope with adversity and become more stress resilient. Families are critical in stress buffering, but other supportive adults in the child's life also can serve to buffer stress, and this includes consistent and supportive teachers and child care providers. Finally, we can intervene in the lives of children who lack sufficient serve and return experiences to develop robust brain architecture, and we can intervene to provide stress buffers and stress buffering experiences to children who are threatened by the conditions that can trigger toxic stress. There are some promising avenues. You'll be hearing about them more today. As I said, you have a handout that sort of reviews what I just said, gives you a website you could go to, the National Scientific Council, for lots more information. And on February 7th, I know you have no time right now, but the Institute of Child Development is putting on a free giveaway, the Science Symposium on Early Experience and the Achievement Gap. And you're welcome to come. A few months later, we'll have it all up on our website, so maybe you can get to it then. Thank you very much.
Ms. Gunner, thank you. And members, I think we'll take questions when all three testifiers are complete. So, Mr. Grunewald.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rob Grunewald, economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. Economists such as myself and Art Rolnick, who recently retired from the Minneapolis Fed, is now at the University of Minnesota. He and I have been reviewing the economic research on investments in early childhood, essentially taking the implications of the brain research that Professor Gunner has explained and looking at those implications on workforce development and also on economic growth. I'm going to walk through a few slides that look like this on your, it's a short handout, four pages. Use some of the graphs there to help illustrate some of my remarks. I think the first thing that economists are noticing and that you have heard of as well, just looking at the first graph that I showed on the first page, is that the growth in Minnesota's labor force is expected to slow over the next few decades compared to previous years. And at the same time, the demand for workers with more skills beyond high school are expected to increase. So making sure that children are prepared to succeed in school and life once they reach kindergarten is very important for the state's economy. On the next page, the top graph shows that there is research that shows the achievement gap between those children who come from families with advantages, such as parents with college education, compared with those children who are coming from families that are living in poverty, that the achievement gap we notice between these two groups in the school system is observed very early as 18 months. And by the age of 3, children who grow up in families with college-educated parents have twice the vocabulary as children who are growing up in poverty. Research also shows that investments in early childhood education can help prepare children to succeed in school and in life. These investments also achieve a high public return. The study of the Perry Preschool Program in Michigan shows that when children from low-income families are provided a high-quality preschool experience with a well-trained teacher that includes home visits to follow up in that home environment during the week, that these children are likely to perform better in school, more likely to graduate from high school, earn more money in the workforce, pay more taxes, and are less likely to commit crime. This study used a randomized trial with an age 40 follow-up, and there was low rates of participant attrition. The chart that you see on the bottom shows the benefits and the costs laid out in the chart. And then on page 3, we add up all of the benefits relative to the cost. And here comes that 16 to 1 number that you've heard of before. This is adding up all the benefits relative to the cost, taking the present value of those benefits. We get a 16 to 1 ratio. We can also calculate the annual rate of return. What is that annual interest rate over the lifetime of these benefits? That annual rate of return is 18%. Most of the benefits are accruing to the public, to the non-participants. We estimate that public return at 16%. The Perry Preschool has been reanalyzed by James Heckman. He's a Nobel laureate economist at the University of Chicago. And he has made a couple different assumptions, still comes out with a very high rate of return at 10%. All of these rates of return are adjusted for inflation and are much higher than the returns that we see in the stock market over a long period of time. Now, historically, the stock market has returned about 6% annually. The next slide on the bottom of page 3 shows the cost-benefit results from three other high-quality early interventions. All of these are reaching children who are at risk. The Abbotsford Educational Child Care Program is providing a full-day experience starting at just a few months old until kindergarten age. Research on this program showed that children were less likely to be retained in grades, less likely to be smoking at age 21, and they were 3 times more likely to go on to college as an adult. The Chicago Child Parent Center Project, which is a study which is overseen here at the University of Minnesota, the lead researcher is Arthur Reynolds. That program provides preschool for 3 and 4-year-olds. Again, benefits look very similar to the Perry Preschool program. And a home visiting program, which used nurses. It's the beginning of the Nurse Family Partnership Program, originally studied in Elmira, New York. Here they found the home environments were made safer, and mothers were able to retain employment longer, and there was reductions in adolescent crime. All of these benefits are over one. So you're getting your money back, adjusted to annual rates of return. They range from 7% up to as high as 20%. And the majority of the benefits are accruing to the public, to the non-participants, and to the taxpayers. On the next page, at the top of page 4, it shows the results of more recent research on preschool programs funded through states. So certainly those long-term studies started many years ago, but we have a lot of research that's coming in now from investments in state preschool programs, especially for 4-year-old children. The research here on these 5 state programs showed that they're finding strong impacts on vocabulary acquisition, math skills, and print awareness. And finally, I'll conclude with the final slide, and that is themes from the lessons learned from the research in terms of investing in early childhood. The first is the importance of investing in quality, well-trained staff, and using a research-backed curriculum that addresses the whole child, including the social-emotional needs and the cognitive development of that child. Second, the importance of involving parents, so that parents are connected to the programs that their children might be at, and also providing parent education opportunities. Starting early, so our continuum of investments are reaching children at a very early age. Reaching the at-risk population will achieve the highest rate of return because here prevention dollars can be spent and used more effectively than remedial programs later in that child's life, which are more expensive and less effective. And finally, bringing to scale. In this state in 2013, only less than a third of children at 185% of poverty and below at the ages of 3 and 4 will be in a high-quality early childhood program. There are many children in this state who would benefit from an early childhood education investment. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Ms. Moss.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Erica Moss. I'm the Executive Director of Parent Aware for School Readiness. My organization, commonly referred to as PASSER, has its roots in a long history of business involvement in early learning and descends directly from the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, which was known as MELF. As some of you may know, MELF sunsetted at the end of 2011 after investing 5 years and $20 million in private money to explore ways of bringing to scale the kinds of returns highlighted by Rob Grunwald just a moment ago. As the heiress of MELF's approximately 2-foot-thick stack of research reports, I'm here today to tell you a little bit about the findings. As I mentioned, in total, MELF invested about $20 million in a large-scale applied research project that built on Art and Rob's lessons: invest in quality, involve parents, start early, and target at-risk populations. The bulk of this investment was made in two key pilots: a project to test the Parent Aware Ratings, which is a 1-to-4 star system for giving parents information about the quality of providers in their area, and Early Learning Scholarships, a mechanism that gives low-income parents access to programs that can prove quality via ratings. For those new to this model, imagine the higher education system with its many providers, public, private, online, etc., and the scholarships provided to students to help them attend those programs. What I'm talking about is an early learning counterpart with scholarships to help children attend an array of providers, centers, home-based, school-based, Head Start, but better, because it doesn't just make scholarships available. It gives parents information about the quality of providers through ratings. The information provided by ratings also gives taxpayers funding the scholarships an assurance that their investment will be used with a quality provider. I'm going to highlight the most significant findings from the MELF pilot. Note that today I'm talking at a summary level, and I'm happy to follow up in greater detail with individual members as at the request. First, low-income children moved into proven quality. The coupling of parent aware and scholarships greatly increased low-income kids' access to high-quality programs. Prior to receiving a scholarship, the majority of children, 57%, were in unlicensed settings. After receiving a scholarship, 100% were attending a program that could demonstrate, thanks to the ratings, that they offered high-quality early education. And the kids we're talking about here, low-income kids, about 75% of the kids who received scholarships in the pilot were from families at 100% of poverty or below, and about half of them, their family spoke a language other than English at home. Beyond moving kids into quality programs, scholarships work for families and providers. 93% of providers viewed the scholarships as helping children stay enrolled in high-quality programs, compared to 70% for traditional government assistance, and 95% of providers working with families using scholarships said that the paperwork and administrative processes associated with it were minimally disruptive to services, compared with 64% who said that of traditional government assistance. Next, ratings improved quality. The number of rated providers increased steadily over the course of the pilot, and the majority of providers moved up at least one star level when seeking a rating for a second time. Among childcare providers who volunteered to be rated, 92% said that the Parent Aware ratings improved their quality. And all types of programs, including smaller licensed home-based programs, were able to achieve high ratings in the Parent Aware system. Over the course of the Parent Aware pilot, at least 24,000 Minnesota children, both low-income and non-low-income, were served in programs committed to quality as demonstrated by their Parent Aware rating. This is a key benefit of this model. It's a model that is systemic in nature. In the pilot, only about 650 children had scholarships, but 24,000 benefited from the rating system. A classic rising tide lifts all boats equation. Finally, and most importantly, children in rated programs made strong gains. Children in settings with parent aware ratings showed significant gains in kindergarten readiness measures such as expressive and receptive vocabulary, phonological awareness, print knowledge, and social competence. In terms of language and literacy measures, low-income children in rated programs made greater progress than the full sample of children. So as first recommended by Art and Rob, and then tested it over a 4-year pilot locally and evaluated by national experts, the Parent Aware Plus Scholarship model has been proved successful in a large-scale pilot. In addition, the model enjoys a wide range of support. The idea has overwhelming public support. A 2010 statewide survey, 96% of Minnesotans statewide agreed that parents should have access to the best available information to help them find the best places for preparing children for kindergarten, which is what the Parent Aware Ratings does. And 73% of Minnesotans statewide agreed that we should only allow tax dollars to be spent on early childhood education providers who have proven they are effective at preparing children for kindergarten. In addition to public support, the model has advocates on both sides of the aisle, and elements of it have been carried forward by the Dayton administration. It also continues to be actively supported by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and Minnesota Business Partnership, as well as by the many CEOs and other distinguished community leaders that were part of MELF and many of whom continue service on the PASR Board of Directors. Just really quickly, what's happening now. Parent Aware is currently expanding statewide and will be available in every county by 2015. The 2010 legislature appropriated resources to create a state-funded scholarship program. Those scholarships are sort of flying out the door as we speak, waiting lists in many areas after only a few weeks of scholarships being available. And this idea was a key component of Minnesota's Race to the Top grant, which is helping to accelerate some portions of it. And finally, the private sector continues to be involved. For example, my organization, PASR, and Greater Twin Cities United Way are partnering to continue an objective, independent evaluation of the Parent Aware rating system that's privately funded to ensure that it works as intended and improves over time. Thank you.
Ms. Moss, thank you. And testifiers, thank you so much for that impressive data and statistics. That's what we're looking for. We do have some questions now. Representative Quam, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the presenters for all the wonderful data. Looking through this and the brain development was interesting. What I gained from there was that interaction with a person is best, with a connected person is even better. So optimally, and I'm not surprised, interacting with the parent would be, the ideal, and then smaller group interactions so that if you're in a large class, maybe you get less total. So basically you want a connected person, or if you're not there in a parent's work, you want to be in an environment where they are in a smaller group. Is there an ideal group that balances interaction with other students and adults?
I don't know. Anyone care to take?
Yes.
Ms. Gunner?
Chairman, representatives. You got it right. That is the story of early brain development. But variety is also terribly important. And the parent's ability to provide the language and concepts and enrichment is also a critical piece. The question about group size, and I'm sure the parent aware ratings are related to age of child, number of children, two providers, and that changes. The younger they are, the smaller the ratio needs to be. The older they are, the more important it is for children to begin to have time to interact with other children. Early on, the fact that the adult can accommodate the child is critically important. Later on, you don't want too much accommodation, and peers are great at not being able to accommodate you, so you learn to accommodate them, and you're learning a different set of skills. So what we need changes. Human beings are critically important all the way through, but richness and various concepts and opportunities to engage the world in different ways are also important, and those are all a part of the parent aware ratings.
Representative Quam, we're going to just hear one more after Representative Quam. We're going to move on, and then there's others on the list, and we'll see what we have time for. So, question, Representative Quam.
Thank you. That also correlates to the MELT chart where home-based or family child care, even though it was 9% of the pool, was 27% of the high quality. But I did want to find out if there's any explanation with the gap in preparedness. Was presented last session that it wasn't fitting any demographic or area, that it was across, metro, rural, urban settings and schools, and that that needed to be addressed universally. But then success in those schools for graduation and achievement gap at the end. So the end result didn't quite correlate with the universal input. So I'm wondering, have you, as you do these longitudinal studies, have you tried to correlate with successful districts and non-successful districts, well, less successful districts, the impact, and be able to do that handoff and best practices throughout, because, you know, when the students graduate, we want them to be successful. And so I was wondering some of the parameters on those longitudinal studies.
Mr. Grunewald?
Mr. Chair, in terms of, we get some valuable evidence from the Chicago Child Parent Center study, because that is a model that does follow up into elementary school with that model that was used in preschool. And there is evidence from that model that certainly the preschool is helping kids get an advantage that is long-lasting, and you're able to see that right on through the Chicago school system. But those kids that do get additional enrichment in early elementary years also find benefit. So an important theme here is that once you invest in early childhood, it's important to follow up with a high-quality school system. Some of the evidence from Head Start was talked about a little bit earlier. While certainly the randomized trial on Head Start that was recently released did show some fade-out on the cognitive measures and so on that were studied there, there's other research that uses large data sets that have been able to watch that kids do find higher achievement levels later on in their schooling. One of those studies was a sibling pair study. And the result, one of the results of that study was it seems that kids from Head Start that do go to school districts that have more resources are likely to sustain those gains longer than children who graduate from Head Start and go to districts that don't have as much resources as the other ones.
Members, I'm going to move to the next set of testifiers. We'll keep the list going here, and we may call back some of you also later, but thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, I'd
yes,
be happy to introduce the next segment.
Please do.
To put some context on this, if you go right from the remarks that Erica Moss made about the role of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, you will remember that there were two things that Minnesota Early Learning Foundation pilot tested for our community. One was the quality rating system, known as Parent Aware, and second was scholarships. And then if you roll the clock back 1 year ago, roughly to this time frame, our state was awarded a Race to the Top grant of $45 million for early childhood education, and our state now has 4 years of funding to implement or to expand some of these great tools that MELF has pilot tested for us. So the Parent Aware Quality Rating System is now expanding statewide and is going to be in every county within another year or so. And we are also expanding the use of scholarships with some of this additional federal funding. So we're here now to give you just a quick snapshot of what's going on the ground in different parts of the state with both the quality rating system and the implementation of the next phase of scholarships. Our four presenters are Barb Faber, who works with the White Earth Indian Reservation, Barb Yates, our chair of the Governor's Early Learning Council, Amy Wallstein, who works with the Minnesota Business Chamber, and Mary Kozak, who's here from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and the Blandin Foundation. We will begin with Barb Faber.
Good morning.
Good morning. If I could ask testifiers, I'm just looking at time, to try to keep it to about 2 minutes, if you can. And so I'm going to give a little signal up here when you hit about the two-minute mark, just so we have time for questions and we can hear all the testimony. So please proceed.
Good morning, and thank you, Chairman, and all committee members. My name is Barb Faber. I'm the director of the White Earth Nation White Earth Child Care and Early Childhood Program, and also chairperson of the National Indian Child Care Association. White Earth Reservation is one of 11 tribal communities in Minnesota. We became a transformation zone with Race to the Top. White Earth Reservation, as you know, is a high poverty, low income, and isolated area. Since we became a transformation zone, we pulled together stakeholders to sit around the table and talk about early childhood, create capacity. Those stakeholders are child care providers, Head Starts, school districts, parents, community members. We work with local providers to help help them with the Parent Aware process and support them. To date, we have 8 providers that are parent-rated under the Parent Aware program, which is a big benefit to children in their care because it's consistency of lesson planning, assessments, observation, parent-teacher conferences, and child care. We also have the parent mentor program that works with the parents. We have parent training to so that parents can receive training on child development, parenting, whatever it is they need. We are reaching at-risk children and connecting them to early childhood programs. One of the issues that we have had is people, school districts and Head Start really want to do this. But the concern is, where is the money going to come from, you know, afterwards? How can they plan and set budgets? This program is working. We have many children that were not in any kind of early childhood setting. They were at home. Now they are getting into early childhood settings, and they're working around high-quality early childhood curriculums, great self-regulations, social and emotional skill building. We're setting the foundation for these kids so that when they get to kindergarten, they are ready.
Ms. Faber, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Yates. Minnesota's Early Learning Council is responsible for advising the governor, the children's cabinet, and the legislature on priorities for supporting our youngest learners. We're pleased by the governor's leadership on early childhood care and education and the importance he's placed on early learning in his 7-point education plan. Now, in the short time since the council has come together, we've made great strides by creating a strategic plan to guide our work. We've supported the successful grant application that brought nearly $45 million in federal funds to Minnesota through the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant. The council continues to provide feedback and advice to the Office of Early Learning over implementation of this effort. And for those of you who don't know, the governor has appointed 22 people from all over Minnesota to the Early Learning Council, and there are four legislators that are actually were waiting for the appointments from the legislature for this legislature. We've been meeting previously before this governor. They met about quarterly. We've actually been meeting monthly to try to get our arms around this issue. We're guided by our strategic plan and 6 listening sessions that we've held around the state of Minnesota to hear in local communities what's going on and what's needed. We've organized our work through 5 topics or issue areas. One is rural and special populations. This group considers the impact of Race to the Top activities and other Early Learning Council recommendations on rural areas and especially on special populations. This is a place to give voice to those concerns and help brainstorm some solutions. Another area of focus is access, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Accountability, where Minnesota is in meeting the needs of our young children, and we're going to let people know about that, how we're doing in those areas. Workforce, to look at recommendations for professional development in this area, and pre-K to grade 3 that will make recommendations to work towards meeting the goal that all children will be reading by 3rd grade. Now, guided by the work of the Access Committee, the Council has voted to support increased access to high-quality early care and education program for children from low-income families as our top priority for this legislative session. The Council has recommended to Governor Dayton and the Children's Cabinet that substantial flexible funds be included in the Governor's budget for fiscal year 2013-2014. These funds will help low-income families access early care and education programming for their children that they otherwise wouldn't be able to access and or afford for the quality experience. That's our only recommendation for this session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next.
Hi, I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Director of Education and Workforce Development Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and also the mom of a 4-year-old who's enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. So the issue with early childhood for the business community, what we're focused on is how we prepared a skilled workforce. And we need to ensure that all students are prepared to receive a globally competitive education when they enter kindergarten. The foundation for a child's educational future does begin prior to kindergarten. Ensuring that every child is prepared to begin is important not only to families, but also key to building the kind of workforce and the kind of economy that makes Minnesota a great place to live. Private and public efforts have demonstrated that kindergarten readiness can be improved through high-quality education programs. And as the other testifiers have outlined, the growing body of research supports the important relationship between kindergarten readiness and successful academic outcomes. And that's important because Minnesota has one of the widest achievement gaps in the nation. So strengthening high-quality early childhood education is one of the important strategies to reducing that achievement gap from the outset. High-quality early childhood education helps attack not only the achievement gap, but also the preparation gap. Now, simply put, some children are much further behind before they even start school. A recent study by the Brookings Institute showed that Americans at the upper end of the income spectrum spend five times as much per child, and an average of 1,300 more hours in home daycare centers and early childhood programs preparing children for school than lower-income families. So helping low-income families access high-quality education, early childhood education, helps narrow that preparation gap. Much has been accomplished to increase high-quality early childhood over the past several years, and there's substantial opportunity for continued progress on this front, particularly in improving quality early childhood programs and early literacy programs, improving the parent-aware quality rating system to help ensure that parents and providers have access to the system, and then providing low-income families with access to early childhood education programs, all essential parts of helping close that preparation gap. I also want to touch very, very briefly on data. This committee has set the important goal of using data to drive decision-making. The state is currently developing several longitudinal data systems that will tie early childhood with K-12, with higher ed, with workforce. Data quality is of critical importance, and we must ensure that the data is accurate, coordinated, and accessible to help and inform and improve early childhood education as well as the rest of the education programs throughout the state.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Kozak, and I'm a program officer at the Blandin Foundation in Grand Rapids, and I have decided to chuck my entire speech. Despite all the time I put on it, all I want to say to you is that we have the expertise here in Minnesota. You've heard some of them. Rob Grunewald, Dr. Megan Gunner, Dr. Richard Chase, Dr. Arthur Reynolds, they're all right here. And they've been, you know, pushing everything, and it's kind of like, why hasn't anybody listened? Well, in Itasca County, we were frustrated back in the, well, I started this in 1998. Finally, in 2003, after Art Rolnick came to Grand Rapids and spoke to our entire community, we really took the bull by the horns and decided to do something. We went to the Blandin Foundation. I'm working there, but the group came to the Blandin Foundation and applied for a grant. What they wanted to do was almost be another Perry Preschool project, but only one right here in Minnesota, and actually in rural Minnesota, to prove that it really could work. So Blandin Foundation, the board of directors, decided to invest a minimum of $1 million a year for a minimum of 10 years, because we wanted this longitudinal study. Actually, they've even committed to 30 years of following these kids, even if they don't fund it beyond the 10-year period. But chances are they are going to. So anyway, we're in year 8 right now. And if you take a look at the year 6, that's as far as we are right now. We're expecting year 7 later this spring. But year 6, look at the highlights. Second bullet. The results show that the proficiency gap has been eliminated between the lower income kids and their higher income peers. Now you're talking, the kids that we've been working with are the neediest of the needy. They have not only low income as a risk factor, but generally about 3 to 5 more risk factors. And yet, they're on par with their higher income classmates, with their higher income classmates. They enter on a level playing field in kindergarten. So just to sum it up, it can happen. Minnesota's ready. You've heard all of these people who are on board. You've got the Mini Minds campaign going. You've got a list of more than 50 organizations that are behind it. Now's the time to act, Minnesota. Come on, legislature. Sit up. Take notice. Do something.
We'll take the roll. Those in favor. No. Thank you very much. We now have time to thank you, all the testifiers, for your wonderful nuggets of information and data. And we have now about 3-4 minutes for questions before we go to the final area here. So, Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Grunewald. I understand you are a co-author with Mr. Rolnick on developing and working on the research for that statistic we frequently hear of 16-to-1 return on investment. And would you expand on telling us about the population that was used to come up with that particular statistic?
Mr. Grunewald.
Mr. Chair, in the Perry Preschool Project, it was 120 children from low-income families in Ypsilanti, Michigan, who were part of that randomized trial. They were randomly selected to be in the Perry Preschool Program or to be in a control group. In the Appositarium Program, it was real similar to the Perry, another group of low-income children, about 120, which is large enough sample to find statistical significance between the groups. In Chicago, it was a large group of kids, over 1,000, that were using a quasi-experimental design, all from low-income families. Finally, the Elmira, New York study, that was also very at-risk expectant mothers.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Grunewald, that is excellent. One of the things I kept hearing is that these were at-risk children, children in poverty. So there's a 16-to-1 return on investment for that particular population. Can we extrapolate that to the entire population? Is that fair to do? I mean, a lot of people are doing it, and I'm just very concerned about that.
Mr. Grunewald.
Mr. Chair and Representative Myra, it's important not to overgeneralize each of these individual studies on another population. Not only is it from a different location, but it's a different time period. Nevertheless, they illustrate the type of benefits that we could expect to see in our state budgets, our local budgets, among individuals, the type of benefits we could see. That's why it's helpful to have the Wilder exercise to take evidence from these studies and be able to localize what that return might look like. But the key themes, as you mentioned, are reaching children who are at risk, low income as a measure, and reaching them in these early years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank everyone who testified. And I come from an area that's been very active in early childhood. I was on a school board for a number of years. My area was a pilot for early childhood itself more than 30 years ago, and we've been a pilot for Parent Aware the last 4 years. So I'm very aware broadly of the research you presented, and I really appreciate your being here. But my question arises from the testimony of the St. Paul schools in relation to the recommendations of Many Minds. I have a concern about school-based programs and the logistical difficulties that were expressed this morning, and whether what the perspective might be of anyone from Many Minds might approach this, but how we can approach the scholarship funding in a way that doesn't create those fundamental logistical difficulties for our school-based programs.
I'm not going to spend a lot of time with this because we're going to probably see a bill that's going to be coming forward where we can really specifically talk about this. So let's do this another time if that's all right, Representative Reinert. Is that okay?
Yes. But can I just make
you may because
all right. So I'll just leave that concern out there. But related to that concern was another point that was raised by St. Paul schools that at a later date you could also answer, and that's the issue of alignment. I'd be very interested, and I know we don't have a longitudinal database to address this in relation to four-star programming yet, but I would hope we would begin to look at our four-star rated facilities and begin to understand whether there's differentiation within those in terms of the question of alignment, because we know how critical alignment is with pre-K and K. So that's just a question for the future.
Representative Reinert, great points. We do have a few more testifiers. We're not going to get to those. I guess if there's questions for individual people, you can maybe catch them before they leave, but I want to thank all the presenters very much for the excellent and riveting testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Yeah. It was our pleasure to be here, and we look forward to a continued dialogue on early childhood education and with the upcoming Many Minds proposal.
Thank you very much. Yep. Next, then, we have the Jewish Family and Children's Services. The testifiers would come forward.
Thank you.
And I think we're right on time, about 10 minutes of testimony and a minute or two of questions if we have. So I'll let you introduce yourself, and please begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Judy Helper, CEO of Jewish Family and Children's Service. I'm here today to talk with you about the Parent-Child Home Program. I want to thank the previous presenters this morning, because now you've heard the research and we have the opportunity to talk with you about implementation, as our program is really an example of all of the important things that you've heard about. It's an example of brain research and of language stimulation and how those go together. It's an example of removing barriers, and it is an example of using parents as their children's lifelong learners, and the importance of both accessing both the children and their parents. So let me tell you a little bit about the Parent-Child Home Program. This is an evidence-based program which has been around for over 45 years. Jewish Family and Children's Service brought this program to Minnesota 7 years ago. It engages children as young as 18 months of age, all the way up to 4 years of age. And it is a program that serves families of those children for 2 years. There are currently 7,000 families in the United States in 14 replication sites that are participating in this program. And let me tell you a little bit about how the program works. It is voluntary for families to participate. They aren't required to do this. And a home visitor, a trained home visitor, comes to their home twice a week. That is called the dosage. There's no other program around that can claim that kind of dosage. So two visits a week for 30 minutes each, and that is provided 30 weeks out of the year for 2 years, for a total of 60 weeks and 120 visits. The home visitor brings a carefully selected toy or book each week, demonstrating how to use that to create language-enriched environment for their child. So it is an opportunity to use the book or the toy to engage the child in language. Many of these books, for example, are things that you would find in commonly in households. You're probably all familiar with books such as Pat the Bunny and Goodnight Moon. So these books become vehicles for talking. And you can show Pat the Bunny and you can read the book, or you can say to the child, what else in your house is fuzzy? What other animals do you know about? And it's an opportunity to engage the child in talk, as are the toys that are brought. While the home visitor is introducing that at the first visit every week, the parent is also participating. At the second visit each week, the home visitor is more of the observer and the resource, and the parent is demonstrating his or her skill in engaging their child in language. It's a very simple program, elegantly simple. There's independent research which indicates that the children and parents benefit significantly from this program. Children who participate in this program outperform at-risk control and comparison groups on various cognitive measures, and they enter school with requisite social-emotional skills. The program participants close both the achievement gap and are working on the preparation gap. And they are demonstrating that these children, with this simple program at such an early stage in their life, actually go on to graduate from high school at the same rate as their middle class peers. The research also shows that parents go on to achieve greater success in their lives academically and professionally. And why we think this program is so important and so complementary to the presenters that you've heard this morning is that our program starts very early. It starts before pre-K. And in terms of systems, our program is a handoff. Ideally, these children and these families participate in our program for 2 years. We help them to access scholarships so that they can then go to a high-quality preschool program prior to entering school. And we want to thank the state, because last year we did receive a 2-year grant from the state to increase our program by 25 families. And so we are eager to let the state know of our success with this program over the next couple of years. I do want to call your attention to the materials. I'm talking quickly because I know I don't have much time, but the packet that you all received, I would encourage you to look through it, because although I've been talking quickly, a lot of the information that I've talked about with respect to the results this program has demonstrated are available in your packet. And I would also mention that the Wilder Research Study, which one of the previous presenters mentioned, is also something which we adhere to. The return on investment is very important to us and applies to this program. And finally, last year, the data on our program demonstrated that 88% of the children completing the second year of our program scored very high in social, emotional, cognitive, language literacy, and physical development based on the ASQ and the ASQ-SE. And there were 12% of our children who were early identified as in need of childhood special education services. So well before they show up at kindergarten, these families were directed to resources in their communities. 99% of our parents demonstrated positive parenting techniques that convey knowledge and understanding of early childhood developmental milestones, such as age-appropriate behavior, expectations, and these were using national evaluative tools. So I will stop and entertain any questions that you might have, along with Deanna Johnson, who is with me from the program, both as a coordinator and a home visitor.
Thank you so much. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is really a delight for me to have JFNCS presenting this morning. My family, for a long time, has been involved in the good work of JFNCS, and I know that it is a very high-quality organization, and we've done a lot of talking this morning about the necessity of making sure that the organizations delivering services are high quality. I did take a look at some of the research of that 45 years of research. The results is gleaned, and it's absolutely amazing what a compliment it is to more traditional early childhood programs. You know, an example of the Massachusetts study where 93% of the children who had both this program and pre-K were ahead of their peers. Chronological age in achievement is really, really amazing. I just want to point out that this is an example of really leveraging the taxpayers' dollars in a public-private partnership, and it with a great return on investment. I do have a question at the end of all of this. You do serve, I think, 125 families. I'm wondering about the criteria for selection, because there's so much need. I'm wondering if there's other organizations that you can refer them to if you cannot take them.
Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We do refer families that we cannot serve to various programs, usually in their school district, depending on their age and what's available in the individual school districts. Your former district, in particular, we have a very good working relationship with referring back and forth in the Hopkins School District. We currently serve about 26 families from that district. Yeah, definitely. There is, you know, many referral sources. We also get a lot of calls from outside of our service area, in Minneapolis in particular, which we currently do not serve except for a small partnership with PPL. But we refer to Way to Grow, for example, and other quality programs.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from members for the witnesses here? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do those scholarships apply to both public and private choices for the parents?
Ms. Johnson.
Are you referring to our program is free for the parents?
Okay.
All of our funding has come from private donors, and as Ms. Helper mentioned, the state. So our program has no charge to the parent.
Oh, okay.
And we've had foundation support as well. But our home visitors do facilitate our families in choosing the high-quality daycare they would like to attend and accessing dollars to attend those daycares.
Okay, so you help the parents out to get the scholarship dollars to make the choices.
We do provide them with education and information.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your presentation and for your work.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today. And I think all the testifiers, I would like to thank. I think this is very encouraging. We have data-proven strategies and efforts that are making a difference. And I think that's a focus of this committee, is where can we get the best value for every dollar that we spend in getting results and closing the achievement gap. So for all those who participated today, thank you so much. Thank you. Members, a quick reminder, tomorrow we will be meeting in joint meeting with the Senate. We will be meeting in room 200. So we will not be meeting here. We will be meeting in room 200 tomorrow. And also, we're not planning to take any testimony on certainly members' questions, but not testimony. We'll just, it's information sake for the members, and so there will be no testimony from other groups at that time. I'm sure there'll be bills coming forward where we'll have a chance to testify. So, anything else? If not, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.